Hey, listeners, on behalf of Vox Vignette here in Austin, thank you for downloading the podcast and being a part of our community, whether it be literally or indirectly. We also want to provide you with the opportunity to join in our mission. We are passionate about the work God has called us to, and the reality is there's a financial cost to that mission. In our first 4 years, we've been active, leading a church, starting and running Space 12, and managing two homes for intentional community. We are excited for what God has called us to, and want to invite you to partner with us. If you're interested and want more information, please go to voxaustin.com, where you'll find more about what's going on and how to get involved. If you'd like to partner with us financially, click on the giving link on the right side of the front page. Again, thanks for being a part of our extended community. We hope that the podcast has been a blessing, or at least a suitable sedative to you and your ears.
Have you guys ever encountered something that was kind of unexpected? Maybe you were just expecting something ordinary, and then you were surprised and blindsided by something extraordinary. Or you were just, you know, in the middle of something monotonous and mundane, and then you get surprised, and something really meaningful and moving happens. I remember a couple years back, there was a season where I was doing a lot of weddings. I think that year I was in the middle of like 15 weddings, so that's quite a bit. While that was happening, someone sent me a YouTube link. It's like, hey, check this out, which of course, whenever anyone sends me a YouTube link, I do not check out, right? So it sat in my box forever, and I remember it was one night. I don't remember what we were doing. I remember I was home alone, and then I just clicked on the link, and I think many of you have seen this, but this is what I saw. Check it out. You guys have seen that, right? A lot of you. And so this is me, alone in my house, watching a wedding video, weeping. It was so beautiful. Right? And I don't know if maybe you've had those moments where you're just caught off guard or you're just not expecting anything. And I feel like sometimes when it comes to the season of Lent, it's like that. Right, we've done Lent before, and this will be another season. It'll be 40 days. We'll lead up to Easter, and you know it'll be nice. But I don't know if we expect anything to move us. I don't know if there's this expectation that maybe God's still alive and at work, and there's these moments of beauty that we encounter that change us and transform us. And so, this morning I wanted to look at a text where Jesus finds beauty in the most unexpected of places and people. And I wanted to walk through that. And so we'll be in John chapter 4. We have it on the screen. So if you want to read verse 4 through 8, just with the neighbor, and then we'll jump into the text. All right, John chapter 4, 4 through 8. Go. All right, so let me set this up for us before we jump in. So this is basically what's happened leading up to this text. In John chapter 3, Jesus has this conversation with someone who's a part of the religious establishment. He comes to see Jesus, but he's so scared to be seen with Jesus, he comes at night. And then he has this conversation, and it's where we get this idea of being born again. It's the only time he uses that language. And we've heard that vernacular, so we're familiar with it. But imagine, like, for the first time, he's like, so born again? Like, seriously? Like, I gotta, like, go back in, right? So there's this really confusing conversation. And then now Jesus gets baptized by John the Baptist because that's his namesake. And so that'd be a good person to baptize you. And then at the beginning of chapter 4, Jesus now starts baptizing. His crew starts baptizing. And then what he doesn't realize is apparently it's a competition. He didn't know that. And the religious establishment's like, they're keeping track. They're like, well, you're baptizing more than John the Baptist. And we kind of had a fantasy pool going. We thought John the Baptist was going to win, so this isn't going to work. And so there's a controversy that apparently gets so heated that Jesus and the disciples have to leave town. Okay? And that's where we pick up the story in verse 4. And it says now he had to go through Samaria. Okay, so now geographically, you had Judea. Okay, I think I got a map, which is further south. You've got Galilee, which is where he's trying to go. And then the problem is they're sandwiching Samaria. They're sandwiching the people group that they've been at war with for 750 years. There's hatred. They've vilified them. Galileans and Judeans saw Samaritans as inferior. They saw them as a mixed breed. They saw their religion to be inferior. So they didn't even talk to each other. Okay? So when people usually had to go from Judea to Galilee, this is the very efficient path that they took. Right? So they would just go around it. Which you would understand, it would be like Hutus and Tutsis. Okay? If you're Hutus, you're trying to get to your tribe around, you would not walk through. Because if you walk through, bad things are going to happen. This would be like a black community going to visit their family in the north, in the south, right? When things were not cool. And if you walk through the community, bad things are going to happen. So this text starts, and then Jesus says this. He had to go through Samaria. Had to. So imagine the conversation between him and his disciples go like this. So you have to. I have to. Not you want to, you have to, right? And so they're like walking into Samaria. They've got their guard up because things might go down. And then now they come to this well. It says in verse 5, so he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of the ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there. And Jesus, as he was tired from the journey, and I imagine just tired from the bickering of, we can't go to Samaria. Samaria. You have to go. No. We don't need to go. We should. Let's just not go, right? So at some point, he's like, okay, how about this? Just go buy lunch. Just get out of here. Go pick up some lunch. Okay? So now he's sitting at the well. And then what time is it? It's around noon. Okay? This is significant because usually if women come to gather water, when would they come? They would come early in the morning. It would be their time of community. They would talk. They would hang out. They would all go back together before the sun came out. Okay? Now, this woman comes by herself. She's alone. She's used to seeing the well completely alone. Now there's someone there. Not only is someone there, there's someone now is a man. Not only is someone a man, he's a Jew. They don't have this conversation, right? Jesus asks, will you give me a drink, right? And then the Samaritan woman says to him, she says, listen, you are a Jew. I am a Samaritan, not just a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? This doesn't happen. What are you doing here? And I love that in this story, that Jesus had to go. There's this community that everyone walked around, and he walked towards. Everyone tried to separate themselves, and he engaged them. And I just thought, how beautiful would it be if in this season of Lent, these groups of people or the person that we define as the other, if you're poor, it's the rich. If the rich, it's the poor. If you're educated, it's the uneducated. If you're educated, it goes back and forth. And those people that we vilify, that we put in these boxes, what would it look like as we're celebrating, remembering redemption, if we went to that other, to the person that we vilify, to the person that we try to avoid, and actually engage them? You know, some of you guys have heard of TED Talks. It's a conference. I think TED stands for Technology, Entertainment, Design. And then they, you know, people from the top of the industry, they give a short talk, and then every year they hand out a TED Prize. Okay, it's for someone who's doing something amazing. They'll give some funding to help them expand their work. So I think former winners were Dave Eggers one year, Jamie Oliver, Bill Clinton. Did anyone see who won the TED Prize for this past year? His name, I think, was JR. He's a street photographer from France. And he would basically take photography, and he believed in public art. In transient art. So he would blow up these huge images, force them into public places, and then he got this idea now to take images where there were divisions. In France, the big division were the suburban ghetto, the suburban thugs, and the urban bourgeois. And so some riots broke out. People were vilifying all these thugs in the suburban ghettos. So he went and took portraits of how the bourgeois characterized them, and then pasted them all over the city. And then after he did that, he went to the West Bank. So check out this clip.
In 2004, I went in Kishimu Fame, suburbs of Paris, to page large photos of the habitants of that neighborhood. A year later, the riot started from there, in 2005, and the first car that burned in front of my picture bring my artwork in the front of the media, suddenly. And I came back in that neighborhood in 2006 with my 28mm to take their photo with their truck. So I portrayed them playing their own caricature, the way we see them from Paris. And I start placing them in the east of Paris, in the bourgeois areas of Paris. And you go from someone in the media that you can't recognize to someone that you can go and knock at his door, because on the photo there is his name, his age, and even his building number. In the same media that I saw the suburb, I saw every day the Middle East conflict. So with my friend Marco, we decided to go there and just have a look by ourselves. With our French passport, we could go from both sides really easily. And we realized that we were the one who had to photograph them and face them face to face on both sides of the wall. So none an Israeli or a Palestinian could have done that project. We met Israeli teachers, Palestinian teachers, taxi drivers, students, photograph them face to face, paint their own caricature, the caricature they see of the others through the media. And we paint them on their wall without any authorization on both sides. And you know what? We thought that we would be kidnapped, that we would be arrested, that we would be evicted. And we just came back with sunburn. The limits in that place were not where we think they are. How can you imagine a guy in Ramallah expect that you paste an Israeli face on his house outside of his own door, and he will have to explain every day why he accepted to have an Israeli in front of his door? The real heroes are sometimes not where you think they are. They are right there in the street, everywhere around you. In the Middle East, I realized that it was the first time I confirmed my work to people who didn't have museums around them.
Isn't that amazing? And he said he was on the Palestinian side of the wall, and he had portraits of two taxi drivers pasted outside of this guy's storefront. And this guy comes out and says, what are you doing? He says, well, I've got an image of taxi drivers, one Palestinian, one Israeli. And then the guy gets upset, and he's like, how can you paste an Israeli on the Palestinian side of the wall? And he's like, you're right. Can you tell who is who? And he said every time he asked that question, no one could give an answer. And to engage these boxes and these categories of who we define as the enemy, and I think it would be so beautiful in this season of Lent, that what if we as the church lived that and participated in it? You know, sometimes here we talk a lot about loving God and loving your neighbor, right? And this is what we say. It's hard to measure how well you love God, right? You're supposed to love God with your heart, soul, mind, and strength. But what does that look like? It's kind of ethereal. So what we say then is, well, look at your neighbor. How well you love them, what they say about you, that's how you measure what that looks like, how what your loving God looks like. I think we need to take it one step further, because the religious person asked Jesus, who then is my neighbor? What's Jesus' answer? A Samaritan, the other, your enemy. And maybe in this season of Lent, if we want to know how well we're loving God, don't just look at your neighbor, look at the other, look at the enemy. And our ability to love them is a reflection of how we love God. You know, for us personally, maybe there's people who's hurt us. Maybe there's conflict with friends just over miscommunication. And maybe during this season, as we remember, as we change, instead of running around, we engage and we run towards. What if we as the church participated? You know, Paul calls this the ministry of reconciliation. What if we found the societal divides and we as a church brought people together? Okay, I have an idea. It would have been much better if I came up with this idea before now, but I just came up with the idea right now. So the TED Prize that this guy won is he now has funding, and anyone can send him any image, and he'll send you back a print, a giant print, and then you can paste it anywhere in the city. So now we, Vox, Spacewell, we've been involved in the school closures, and there's been this divide between the east side schools and the west side schools. So what if we commissioned our photographers in Box, which we have a lot, what if we went and took portraits of kids on the east side and the west side? What if we now had a Dropbox, and you all, if you're not a photographer, that's fine. Just take the image and mail it to them. When we get the prints back, what if we pasted images of children on the east side on west side schools? And then what if we pasted images of children on the west side on east side schools? And what would it look like for our church in this city to actually participate in places where there's a divide, and instead of going around, to engage? And so this is what Jesus does, and it freaks everybody out. So he has this conversation now with this woman, and if you read it, it's a really weird conversation, okay? So she starts out, and she goes, okay, so we're not supposed to drink together, right? There's these walls. It's not supposed to happen. And then Jesus says this, well, if you knew how amazing the gift I was about to give you, you would have asked me for water, right? And then she goes, okay, so I don't see anything that you're holding in your hand. How are you going to draw from the well? How is this going to even work, right? And then he goes, verse 13, he says this, everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. You guys have been coming for centuries to drink from this well, but whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water, welling up to eternal life. It'll be perpetual. It'll keep renewing itself. So she doesn't get this. I read a couple commentators who say that maybe her response is facetious. Like she's being sarcastic, right? So the woman goes, oh, yeah, so, you know, this water is amazing. So why don't you give me some of that water, right? Then I don't have to keep coming day after day. And then now, he changes the subject, right? He takes a twist in this conversation, and then he goes, go, call your husband to come back. And then she goes, I have no husband. And he said to her, you're right. When you say you have no husband, the fact is you've had five, not one, not two, not three, not four, but five. And the man you now have is not your husband. What you have just said is quite true. Then if you read in the story, she goes back to the ethnic religious divide, right? She goes, okay, you're a Jew, I'm a Samaritan, I worship on this mountain, you think you worship in another place. That's our disagreement. Maybe we should talk about that first. And then Jesus' answer is like, well, we're kind of both wrong. Worship is actually not limited to geography. It's about spirit and truth. And true worshipers worship in the spirit and truth. And then in verse 25, like, she's almost so confused where she goes, okay, I have no idea, but one day there's gonna be a Messiah that comes and he'll explain all of this, right? I have no idea what you're talking about. And then Jesus, for the first time to anyone, says, I am he. So what's going on here? Like, there's water, there's thirst, there's this deal with their husbands, and then this acknowledgement that he's the Messiah. This is what commentators are saying. Jesus takes this metaphor of water that's primal and human, that everyone has, right? Everyone can connect. And he says, just like that longing, that thirst for water, there's this more central longing for God, and we fill it with everything and anything. She fills it with husbands, with intimacy, with affection. We fill it with career and success and accolades and clothing and cars and houses. And then we keep thirsting and thirsting, and this stuff that we're filling us with makes us more thirsty. And then Jesus goes, I am he. That thirst that you're thirsting for is me. See, maybe it's like this. So I have very poor thirst, like radars, or like when I'm never thirsty. I just go from not thirsty to like severe headache. So there's like something I'm missing in between there. So, you know, often it'll be 4:30, Karen will call me, hey, how's your day? I was like, I got a pounding headache. She's like, oh, really? Again, huh? Pounding headache? What did you drink today? I was like, well, had an Americano. She's okay. And then anything else? I was like, Had some drip coffee after that. It's okay, good, good, good. Anything else? And then, oh, a macchiato. Also had a macchiato. She's like, have you had any water? I was like, no. And you have a headache and you don't really understand what's going on. I was like, oh, I need to drink, right? So it's like an ongoing thing. Like it like happens often. So one time I was going out for a ride. Someone had told me about this trail up by Lake Travis called Lime Creek. And he was like, would you like riding on the countryside of Italy? Yes. He's like, that's what it's like. So the next day I hopped on my bike. I got up and I opened my fridge and, you know, I had just taken a quick bite to eat. And then I opened my fridge and then I was about to get water and I saw a can of Coke. We never have Coke. I think there's a barbecue in our neighborhood and we had some extra Coke. So I was like, oh, boy. Tough decision, right? Water, which would be really probably wise, and Coke, which would just be really delicious, like right now, right? So I opted for the Coke and then just hit the road. I only had one bottle with me. It was farther than I thought. It kind of got lost. By the time I got there, I'd probably done 40 miles, and then I hit this path of Lime Creek. I think I have a picture here. So it's just winding roads. There's no cars. There's nothing out there. But this picture took place because I hit a point where I was like enjoying the epic scenery and the ride. And then like it hits me that I'm dehydrated. I start getting lightheaded. My mouth now starts getting parched to the point where I have to pull over. So I'm sitting down. I'm thinking, what should I do? I have no more water. I only have one bottle. There's no cars, no houses. I said, okay, this will be my plan. I will now, the next truck or car I see, I'm going to flag them down, like just throw myself in front of it. And then beg for water. That's how desperate I was. Or I'll just knock on the next door I see. So I go another, it wasn't that long, maybe 10 minutes, but it felt like forever. And then there was this one last hill, and I was like, I don't think I'm gonna make it. So I'm like pedaling, and my mouth is parched, I'm getting lightheaded. And then I turn the corner, and I don't know if you guys have been to Valente Beach, and it's kind of like this crappy little like beach in Austin, and it's not cool. But I was so happy to see it. And there was a vending machine there. And I wanted to hug the vending. Like, I wanted to lick the vending machine, right? And there was, like, this thirst that I never get that. But I think this picture of just thirst and what we feed ourselves is kind of this connection that Jesus is talking about. Someone asked me recently. They're like, Gideon, do you think you're going to spend the rest of your life in Austin? And I said, I'd love to. I love Austin. I feel called here right now. And I said, then they asked me, if you could be anywhere else, where would you be? And I said, well, I really want to live outside of the developed world at some point. And they're like, why? And I said, doing what I do and leading church communities, you're trying to offer something that's life-giving and valuable. But in North America, it's like we've got a society of people drinking corn syrup, and you're offering them water. They no, I'm good. I like corn syrup. It's tasty, right? Makes me happy for like 5 seconds, right? And then you now have to like deconstruct all the corn syrup before they're even willing to take water. And the society and the world that we live in, there's this longing. And especially in North America, we have so many creative ways to fill that longing with lesser things, with relationships, with careers, with jobs, with houses and cars. That doesn't even make sense. And Jesus now is offering us something rich and lasting. And I think sometimes people during Lent ask why we fast. And it's not going to make you more spiritual. It's not going to add to anything. But I think it's you pull away from the corn syrup, from the quick fix. And you realize how much you need those things. And when it's pulled away, we engage the longing of God that's built in us. And so in the story, she's confused. She's like, I don't understand this connection to husband and water. And he's like, you know, I was having a conversation last week, actually. A friend came back to visit for South By. He had just gotten a job in Houston. I asked him how things were going. He was like, hey, it's pretty good. I was like, do you like it? He's like, it's okay. I was like, he's like, it, you know, pays well. I was like, do you see yourself the rest of your life? He's like, I don't, but I don't know what to do. And then he goes, and everyone at my company is the exact same way. They're there. They're not really happy, but they got a job. And so they're not willing to do anything. And what I said to him is that longing, that dissatisfaction, don't let go of that. And don't substitute it. Don't just take the paycheck and start buying things to get the quick fix. And lean into that longing and find out where God is in that. And so Jesus has this conversation with her. And so somehow at some point, it clicks. He goes, I am he. So now she goes back to her town. And then at the end of the text, it says that she goes to the town and tells. And then everyone in the town believes, which historians say was like, unreal, because one, she was ostracized and marginalized. She was at the well herself. She probably every day had to take the walk of shame back into her city, and people are whispering, and there she is again. Like, how many more husbands is she going to have, right? And then she talks to them, and then they listen. Then they listen, and then they invite Jesus to come be with them, and then the whole town is changed. It's unbelievable. And what I think is amazing in this text is you have this woman, the first person that Jesus tells that he's the Messiah is an enemy in a patriarchal society, a woman, and someone who's ostracized and marginalized. And everyone saw her as marginalized, ostracized, maybe unjustly. They saw her maybe as a whore. And Jesus saw her as the image of God, the beauty of God. And what would this look like in this season of Lent if we stop seeing people as boxes? Instead of black and white, we saw the image and the beauty of God. Instead of rich and poor, we saw the image and the beauty of God. Instead of Hutu and Tutsi, we saw the image and the beauty of God. Instead of Pashto and Hazara, the beauty and the image of God. What if we saw it in everyone, in every person we encounter, that beauty? I was with an elderly pastor maybe about two months ago. And so I, one, love the elderly. I feel like we live in a society, we're all about like innovation and young people and change. And I feel like people who have experience have so much to offer. And so I just sit with them and ask them questions. And then if I can get the ear of an elderly pastor, I'll just sit them down and just ask them, what was it like? What was ministry like? And I'll always ask them two questions. I'll ask them, what was the hardest point in your 30, 40 years of ministry? And they'll have a lot of stories that will tear your heart out. But then I'll always ask them, what were your most beautiful stories? And they'll always have a ton of stories. And it kind of, you know, made me realize that leading and being a pastor is kind of bipolar. You don't have many experiences in the middle. You have a lot on both ends. And so 2 months ago, I was with this elderly pastor. He's African-American. He had been pastoring in Portland for the last 30, 40 years. He had the first intentionally multicultural church on the West Coast. He started in the 60s, stood up in a black congregation and said, we're going to be multicultural. And people were like, what? Right? And so he told me all these unbelievable stories. And then he told me some stories of heartache. And I said, you know, what are some things that really stand out? And he said, Gideon, there was this young man that I met. His name was Melvin. He said, the first time I met Melvin, he was just a neighborhood kid in the inner city. He started coming to our church. And, you know, it was a small community, so I gave him rides sometimes. And he said, I started noticing that every time I drove him home, he'd just ask me to drop him off at the park. And the first couple times, I was like, oh, this kid loves parks, right? And then later, I dug into it a little bit more, and I found out that his dad had abandoned him and his mom, and they were living in the van. And so the church kind of, you know, arranged a place for them to stay, and they kind of got back on their feet. And then this kid, Melvin, would just always come to his house for dinners and just always, you know, eating, hanging out, playing in the backyard. And then he said, we would have these Bible classes, and you'd have, you know, six or seven of these kids, and I would just teach them the Bible. And then he said, at the end of every class, he would have this mantra that they would say together, and then they would say this. He would say, repeat after me. They would repeat after me, and he called it, what did he call it? He called it the I am a dream, oh, I'm a world changer. That's what he would say. So he's like, repeat after me. I'm a world changer. And They go, I'm a world changer. And you go, I can change my world. They all repeat, I can change my world. And then they repeat, I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. Philippians chapter 2, they would repeat it. And they go, I am God's workmanship. Ephesians chapter 2. And then every day for years, they would repeat this. And then he graduated from high school, and then they lost touch. He said a couple years ago, he got a phone call. And he picks up the phone. He's like, hey, Pastor Henry. He's like, hey, who's this? He's like, this is Melvin. And he hadn't talked to him in years. He's like, Melvin, do I know you, Melvin? He's like, do you remember I used to come over to your house? He's like, oh, Melvin. And he's like, what have you been up to? And for the last few years, he had graduated high school, went to college, really got connected to drama and theater, graduated with a degree, was touring Europe with a theater group, dancing and doing theater. And he had just written a one-man play on Broadway and was now starring in it. And he said, Pastor, I have my own Broadway show, and I want you to come see it. I'll fly you here, and I want you and your wife to come. And so Henry and his wife got on the plane, flew to New York, and he said he was sitting there in the audience, and this one-man show, he said it was brilliant. And then at the end, the standing ovation, and he came back out for the curtain call, and everyone is standing. And then Melvin goes, I want everyone to repeat after me. He goes, I am a world changer. And everyone goes, I am a world changer. I can change my world. I can change my world. I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. I am God's workmanship. I am God's workmanship. And I looked over. We were sitting in the lobby of a hotel in San Diego. And I looked over at Henry, and as he was telling me this story, like tears were flooding down his face. And this young kid that everyone just saw as an inner city kid, he saw the beauty and the image of God. This woman that was ostracized, marginalized, Jesus saw the image and the beauty of God. You have Peter, who was blue collar, a fisherman, uneducated. He was erratic and spontaneous. Everyone saw him as unreliable, but Jesus saw the beauty and the image of God. You have this woman, Mary, who's probably a prostitute, who people say probably everyone saw her for external beauty and her looks and used her for it. And Jesus saw so much more and saw the image and the beauty of God. And what would it look like if not just our community here, for every community in the city of Austin, every community around the state of Texas, this country, this world, and we entered into those places of violence, of division and tragedy, and instead of seeing Hutu and Tutsi, the beauty and the image of God, instead of seeing black, white, Latino, Asian, the image and the beauty of God, instead of seeing rich or poor, the image and the beauty of God. And I'll just close with this. So recently, my sister stumbled onto an old photograph of my father. And he took this picture when he was the exact same age I am now. And I have a picture of it. And so I thought that was pretty awesome. So I threw it on Facebook. Apparently, my father is prolific on Facebook. He's very active. Him and all his friends started commenting on it, right? And then one of our family friends said, wow, that looks exactly like, you look exactly like Gideon. And then he responds under it. He goes, oh, our family friend's name is Flora. Oh, Flora, that is Gideon. And then he was in town at the time, and I just sat him down. I was like, hey, Dad, you know that picture I threw up? He said, yeah, you look just like me. And I was like, Dad, that is you. And I pulled up the picture, and he just looked at it for like a long time. And I wonder if sometimes, like for me, when I talk about seeing the image and the beauty of God in others, I actually find that it's easier for me to do that in others than it is for myself. And sometimes there's these, like, people will say things, well, when God sees me, he sees Jesus, he sees his, right? Like, what does that even mean? And that in this Lenten season, to see as God sees, the beauty and the image of God, literally God, when he sees us, and then to see the world as he sees us. Let's pray together. And so, God, we ask that in this season, that will see you in people, in places of division, in places even of our own hurt. And as we live as the church, to participate in that and to bring that to the world around us. And we pray in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit.